And now, a statement from Ken Rudin.
I have let the listener down, and I regret those transgressions with all of my heart. I have not been true to my values and the behavior the listener deserves. I am not without faults, and I am far short of perfect. I am dealing with my behavior and personal failings behind closed doors with Ron Elving and the listener. Those feelings should be shared by us alone.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, this week we must begin in the far-off climes of Afghanistan.
As Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan.
This was a fateful decision by the Obama administration and by the president, and this could well define his presidency.
You know, it's interesting you say by the Obama administration and by the president, because it was a group deal. It went on for months, highly publicized deliberation. So it really has been an agonizing process leading to this eventual speech by the president to the military academy at West Point.
And I thought it was a very good speech, by the way. I thought it was well delivered.
Are you talking about the delivery now or the writing? Because it read to me like a legal brief, and a lot of it sounded like a good constitutional law professor holding forth in front of a class.
And I've heard people say that, but I thought he just made the case that the administration wanted to make why American troops should be there. But having said that, the question I was left with was what minds were changed, and I'm not convinced many minds, if any minds, were changed.
I don't think minds were particularly changed, and I think you make the point again when you say he made the case, because it's really lawyerly. And I watched the cadets as they were listening, and they very rarely applauded until toward the end when he got into some of the rhetorical flourishes and use of the flag and patriotic language. At that point, they warmed up a little bit, but through most of it, they were basically being given a lecture that did not seem to inspire quite the feelings that they might have had, for example, when George W. Bush came before the academy, of course, different students at the time, to pitch the coming war in Iraq in the summer of 2002.
We must take the battle to the enemy, disrupt his plans, and confront the worst threats before they emerge.
But the way Congress is dealing with it is most interesting, because the right doesn't seem very satisfied.
Well, they can't, though. I mean, can you imagine any element of the Republican Party in the current Congress saying, hey, that was a great speech by the president, and I think he's really hit the head of the nail on this one. I love the president now.
Well, they did say that they like the policy, but they don't like the timetable for withdrawal, because it sends a signal to al-Qaeda or Taliban or the Pakistani government or the Afghanistan government, whatever you could call these governments, if they're governments.
If they're governments at all.
Right.
And clearly it says to someone who doesn't need too much encouragement in thinking this, that our commitment is time limited and that the political support for being there for very long just doesn't exist. But I think we all know that.
Right.
I mean, the polls already show people don't want us to be there any longer. They don't necessarily
want us to. Well, they want us to be there. They don't want American troops there, but they want you and I to be there.
And I think that would be a good substitution. But if the American people had their way, this whole thing wouldn't be happening. Nobody feels very good about it. But on the other hand, if you were to announce we were simply withdrawing overnight and leaving the situation to whatever forces, that would not be a popular decision either. So there were two messages here. One was, we're going to go in and do a better job with a better strategy with more troops. And the other message was, we're not going to stay there very long. In fact, I'm going to set a date for when I plan to start getting out.
And you saw, which was striking to me, you saw that the number was 30,002 troops. And I thought that was a surprise until I realized those two gatecrashers are also going to Afghanistan.
The Salahis are on their way to Kandahar.
So
I think there's something sort of appropriate about that, because they clearly want to be where the fighting is, don't you think?
Not that they like the publicity or anything like
that. No, they'll have a hard time with their shyness. Okay, apart from the mortal threat posed to the president and his entire program by Mikhail and Tarek Salahi, what about the Democratic Party? What about the president's own folks? Aren't they supposed to be really behind him when he makes a major commitment of U.S. forces like what he's doing in Afghanistan?
Well, when you think of Lyndon Johnson and Gulf of Tonkin...
Do I have to think of Lyndon Johnson?
You do, because that's what I thought of when I was watching that speech.
Well, but when I wasn't born yet. But tell me about 1964, Uncle Ken.
Air action is now in execution against gunboats and certain supporting facilities in North Vietnam.
When Lyndon Johnson pushed through the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in the summer of 1964, all the Democrats, except for two Democratic senators, Morris and Greening of Alaska, supported Lyndon Johnson. When Bush 1 went into the Persian Gulf War, the Republicans were behind that. When Bush 2 went into Iraq, the Republicans
and Afghanistan.
But this time you have the specter of a president without the support of his own party. It's the Democrats who have given the hardest time, and rightly so, because of the faltering economy, because if we're going to do any nation building, we should start at home. And we've heard that argument a lot. How do you pay for it? As David Obey of the Appropriations Committee would ask over and over again, do we do it with a surtax? Now, not that a surtax is feasible or likely, but there are questions out there that have not been answered sufficiently for the Democratic Party.
That's right. There are legitimate policy questions about cost, about the length of the mission, about all those things. But doesn't it boil down, really, to the fact that the Democratic Party has not been excited about the Afghan or Iraq missions for a number of years now?
Nor have the American people.
As a party in the House, the Democrats voted against the authority to go into Iraq all those years ago in the fall of 2002 when the tide was really running in favor of the war on terror. So you certainly don't expect them to be any more excited about having a lot of American troops over there and committing us to that sort of a role.
Can I interrupt for 1 second?
Even with the Democratic president.
But let me interrupt for 1 second, because there were a lot of Democrats who supported the Vietnam War when Lyndon Johnson was running it, and as soon as Richard Nixon began running it, they suddenly became opponents.
But it wasn't so sudden either, because a lot had changed between 64-65, and by the time came in 69, and at that point, the war really looked lost.
I'm talking about 68, 69. A lot of people who were very quiet about the war suddenly became vocal opponents. And I'm just wondering, these Democrats did have this opposition from the beginning. But listen, if they listened to Barack Obama himself said this was the right war.
Barack Obama ran against the war on terror to a large degree in 2007 and 2008. Now, of course, then the focus was on Iraq. But the focus is no longer on Iraq. Iraq is, in some sense or another, reaching an acceptable conclusion for at least the moment. One hopes that it continues to do so. But Afghanistan has blown up. Afghanistan has gone from being the war that we sort of thought we knew what we were doing in to the one where we suddenly have a much greater prospect for failure than anyone ever imagined. So Barack Obama has hung this around his own neck, largely, by calling it a war of necessity as a candidate and in his first year as president.
This war has been going on for 8 years, approaching nine, so this is not a creation of the Barack Obama administration, and yet this is Obama's war.
As of the speech at West Point, he makes a species of this war, that is, the war from now on, his own.
And with Afghanistan, with unemployment, with the possible conclusion of health care, that will define how the Democrats do in 2010.
Yes, although there will be other issues as well. As health care proceeds on the Senate floor in December, the House is going to take up the re-regulation of the financial services industry. Many of the things in that bill are going to be unpopular. People on both the left and the right are terribly unhappy about the way the banks were bailed out and how some of those banks that have paid back the money that they got from the government are giving huge bonuses to some of their executives again, and they are not lending to small businesses the way everyone had hoped they would a year ago. There is some loosening up of credit, but it's not nearly as good as it needs to be, so unemployment remains above 10%. People are still going to be more upset about that than probably any of these other issues. So we aren't really sure what the landscape will look like for the Democrats next fall yet, but we do know that the number one issue before them is still probably going to be the economy.
Stupid. And speaking of 2010, we don't have to wait until January 1st. Next Tuesday, December 8th, four Democratic candidates are running for the nomination in Massachusetts. The seat currently held by Paul Kirk, but of course held for decades by Ted Kennedy.
And Paul Kirk, the appointee after Kennedy's death.
Right. And if we're seeing a lot of disunity among Democrats nationwide over Afghanistan, over healthcare, things like that, there's a remarkable amount of unity among the four Democrats who are seeking the Democratic nomination for the Senate in Massachusetts.
That's right, because they pretty much all figure that it's going to be a liberal hardcore base in Massachusetts that chooses which one of them is going to be the Democratic nominee. And in January, the Democratic nominee assumes that that person will win.
Basically, the Massachusetts Senate race is turning into Martha Coakley and the Three Dwarfs. It's really, she's a state attorney general. She's the only woman in the race. She is the best known, and she has held the lead from the beginning. There are some rumors that the Kennedy family are not crazy about her, that she didn't show Ted the proper respect by announcing within...
She got in a little early.
But, I mean, her lead has stayed the same, and I guess Mike Capuano, the congressman from Boston and Cambridge, was probably going to finish in second place, but it doesn't seem like he's going to come close.
And maybe if it were just he against Martha Coakley, he would have a shot, but because there are three people dividing the non-Coakley vote, it looks like she's in pretty good shape. And for January as well, wouldn't you say?
Well, yes, although there are some people who wonder if she gets a bare plurality of the vote, if she gets like 35-40% of the vote. The Republican pipe dream, of course, is that Scott Brown, who's likely to win the Republican nomination, he's an attractive young state legislator, he could rally the independents, the Tea Party people, the conservatives, and the disaffected Democrats who didn't like Martha Coakley.
That would be an interesting coalition for Scott to yeah, rally.
Very unlikely.
I'd like to attend one of those rallies.
Yes.
One candidate who will not be in the lists in 2010 is Tennessee's John Tanner from the western part of the state, one of the founders of the Blue Dogs Caucus and the person who connected the Blue Dog Caucus to Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the House Democratic leadership. He was the chief deputy whip responsible for the Blue Dog vote. He has announced his retirement.
A lot of people are trying to draw parallels between 1994, when the Republicans won the landslide victories, captured the House and the Senate, and comparing it to what could happen in 2010. One big difference is that back in 94, there were a lot of Democratic incumbents, many in the South, who retired. This year, so far, it's only two. It's Dennis Moore of Kansas and now John Tanner of Tennessee. If there's an increase in retirements, that a lot of longtime Democratic incumbents decide they've had enough, they're nervous about their prospects with 2010, then you might see the beginning of a potential big Republican year for next year. But until then, I think it's too early to draw parallels.
Now, John Tanner is a good example of a guy who is a National Guard officer. He had been full-time military early in his career before he was a practicing lawyer. He was very popular in his mixed rural suburban part of the state. And he was probably going to be just fine for as long as he wanted to run for re-election in the House. But as soon as his seat is open, now it's going to be highly competitive. And again, in Kansas, probably the one guy who would be safe in that district, and it's the most Democratic district in the state, but still, it's Kansas. Dennis Moore was probably the one guy who could count on getting reelected there or holding that seat for the Democrats. So those retirements are a good illustration of what you're talking about. We have another election that's still hanging fire down in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, it is probably the closest election in Atlanta history, and what's so fascinating about this is that it was the black candidate, Kasim Reed, a former state senator, who was the establishment candidate, and it was a white candidate, Mary Norwood, who was the outsider, and which is so unlike every other place in the country, but I guess in Atlanta, the cradle of civil rights.
And with a huge and block voting African-American population.
But smaller than it had been 5 years ago, and even smaller
that
than 10
true.
Years ago. Mary Norwood is down about 600, 700 votes. She's demanding a recount. Kasim Reed, who was the establishment pick, he used to work for Shirley Franklin, who's the term limited mayor. He's already making plans about picking a new police chief, things like that. But I still suspect that Reed wins, but a much closer than expected race.
We've also had some other significant votes around the country that affect issues. And I'm thinking here about the vote in the New York State Senate, which we've talked about and laughed about at times mm-hmm. in the past year, as they've had some strange internal goings on and strange internal mechanics. They took up a serious issue. And to the surprise of a lot of gay advocates and activists around the country, dealt a pretty decisive defeat to a gay marriage bill in that state.
Well, that was the big surprise, the fact that it was decisive. First of all, the Assembly had passed it just the day before by like an 88-51 margin.
It was not close.
The Democrats...
And they've passed it more than once.
Right, they had to pass it. Actually, it was a strange technicality in the New York law that you have to pass it more than once. But in the state Senate, which is nominally a Democratic-controlled, although I don't think anybody controls that state Senate.
No one controls that state Senate.
But there are two more Democrats than there are Republicans. Not a single Republican, none of the 30 Republicans voted for it. And eight Democrats voted against it as well. It failed 38-24. A lot of freshmen voted against it. And it's very strange because in New York, the way the state Senate works, you don't bring a bill to the floor and think it's, you know, without guarantee that it's going to pass. And not only did it not pass, it failed by 14 votes.
Now, is that the Didi Scosafava effect to some degree? Is this the fear that was put into Republicans, certainly in New York State, but even some Democrats, that the rising anger, if you will, of perhaps a small minority of people, but a very activist and voting minority of New Yorkers outstate, perhaps away from the metropolitan area, is making itself felt right now?
Well, that's a very good point, because the Democrats up in that area, the upstate New York, the 23rd Congressional District, they voted against it as well. What I'm hearing, what I'm reading, is that there were Republicans, some Republicans, who were willing to vote for it, but only if the Democrats had enough votes to guarantee passage. The fact that there was so much hesitation among Democrats, Republicans said, look, we're not going to bail out the Democrats on this.
This is one more in a series of high-profile defeats for gay marriage in terms of big state votes, Maine, California, and also in terms of state legislatures.
Right. There are still only five states that recognize same-sex marriages. A lot of people thought New York would be the sixth, and it's not going to happen.
So this is a movement that has to fall back and reconsider its tactics at this juncture. They have not been successful at the federal level since the Defense of Marriage Act back in the Clinton years, and they're attempting to repeal that with the respective Marriage Act that is now introduced in the House, but which does not appear to have any sort of a life in the Senate.
And every state where voters have had a say on gay marriage, the voters do not favor it, or at least they're afraid of it. And we also see that state lawmakers are very nervous about voting for same-sex marriage because there is always an election around the corner.
At the same time, and in one of those ways in which public opinion can move in two directions at once, it appears that even as gay marriage per se is not finding success with the voters or in legislative bodies, the approval for civil unions is going steadily upward.
That's correct.
And people are more accepting of that as a concept than they have ever been. And if you compare this to 20, 30 years ago, when that was still something of a controversial or foreign concept, that has changed remarkably, almost as a kind of counterweight in the public mind to gay marriage.
There was one story that was on national news all week that had really nothing to do, on its face, had nothing to do with politics, and that was a tragic story about this former convict who had allegedly killed four Washington State near Tacoma, Washington police officers. He was later gunned down near Seattle. But this guy named Maurice Clemens, happened to be given clemency by then Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee in 2000.
That's right. He had had a crime spree in Arkansas as a teenager. And Huckabee, as part of what was something of a campaign, really, to grant clemency to particularly young offenders.
1,033 either pardons or reduction of sentences in his
clemencies. And pardons and reductions of sentences. That is a lot in one small state.
Far more than his three predecessors combined.
And one of his predecessors, of course, was Bill Clinton, who served for, a generation?
And Jim Guy Tucker served in prison.
So I don't think anyone will bring that up as an issue against Mike Huckabee as a candidate for president in 2012's Republican primaries. Do you think, Ken?
Maybe Michael Dukakis might bring it up.
Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
You know, this is graphic language, and we're sitting here wincing, listening to the specifics in this ad, but
it's really not anything worse than what Maurice Clemens has done.
No.
Over the course of his career. I mean, he's deceased, we were saying alleged shooter, but right, there doesn't seem to be any doubt that he is the person who shot these four policemen in a coffee shop, execution style, and some of his other crimes are extraordinary.
While Mike Huckabee may have done everything according to on the up and up, maybe his intentions were good, as I assume
Michael Dukakis's
intentions were good. The point is, and we're talking about politics.
We're not talking about a moral or ethical universe here. We're talking about what happens in a political campaign, and you can make the ad yourself. If you want the Republican presidential nomination in 2012 and you think Mike Huckabee is in your way, and you know he has a plurality in some polls among Republicans for their nomination in 2012. And one assumes people don't walk away from that position in the polls and decide not to run. So we assume Mike Huckabee is running.
If it was a legitimate issue against Michael Dukakis in 1988.
And that's a big if.
It certainly is a big if. It could be very well repeated against Mike Huckabee in 2012. Now, Huckabee on his Fox News show said the other day that he was leaning against running. Now, I don't know if that was just being coy, but the point is, be it Mitt Romney, Tim Pawlenty, Sarah Palin, whoever is going to run for president, if Mike Huckabee is seen as a threat, as you say, we will hear the name Maurice Clemens as much as we heard Willie Horton in 1988. We're not saying that's good, we're not saying that's right, but we are saying it's politics.
We're not saying anything except that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Pardon me?
I beg your pardon. I never promised.